This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I think Stephen felt the same way. He felt that people would find science beautiful, and it was beautiful and deep and important to the human experience, but there weren't a lot of people making it accessible.
You're listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.
Hello, I'm Alexander McNamara, online editor at sciencefocus.com. And some of our long-time listeners might recognise our interview this week, which we've republished from an earlier episode. The reason we're doing this is because this episode comes out 2 years to the day that the great physicist Professor Stephen Hawking was interred at Westminster Abbey. And at the time of his death, we spoke to one of the people that knew him best, Leonard Mlodinow. Leonard is an American theoretical physicist who worked with Stephen on the books The Grand Design and A Briefer History of Time. And he spoke with BBC Science Focus editor Daniel Bennett about writing together, his qualities, and what they did when they weren't talking physics.
How did you first come to meet Stephen and work with him?
Actually, the first time I met him was at Princeton in the 70s when he gave a talk when he could still speak. And he, I'm a physicist, so I was just at a regular talk that he gave. And he had a graduate student who would stand next to him and translate, because even though he could speak, it was kind of garbled. We got working together after he read my first book, Euclid's Window, and he liked it apparently, and was looking for someone to work with that he liked the way they wrote, and who also was a physicist. Or so there's not many of them, I guess. But anyway, he liked the book, and so he contacted me and asked if I wanted to work with him. So I didn't have to think too long about that one.
And so, what was your work with him like? How did you work together?
Well, we would do certain things apart, and then we would be together for other times and sit side by side, really elbow to elbow, and go over every word. So, he came. I was at the time on the faculty at Caltech, and he comes to Caltech every year, or he used to. He used to until his last few years of his life. He came, I would say, 4 weeks. Roughly speaking, about a month a year, every year. So we would work pretty intensely for that month, and then I would go out to Cambridge. I don't remember, two or three times a year, every quarter, let's say, for roughly a week usually, and we'd do the same thing there. And we would just start in the morning and sit there till, like quit about 8 p.m. and go have dinner and together. And so when we would when we were apart, we would each have our assignment to write a certain section or, you know, and then when we were together, we would go over each other's stuff. And, you know, that was kind of the process.
So what was he like to write with as a writing partner?
Well, I think that's a 2-hour answer, but let's see. There's a lot of angles to it. First of all, there's the experience of working with him. So because of the way he communicated at the time, for most of the time when we were together, there was about 6 words a minute. It started out at 6, it went down to like 1 or 2. Mm-hmm. Then he changed his method of communication, went back up to about 6, and gradually went down again. So I'm sure you know how he communicated. I don't have to go into that. But it would take minutes for each word. At first I would sit there and, I'm getting used to it. I don't know what to do. I'm daydreaming. while I'm waiting for his answer. And then I realize I'm sit right next to him, really close to him. I can actually see his screen. He didn't seem to mind that. So then before he would finish a sentence, I could answer it if I knew what he was saying. Or more importantly, I could start thinking about what he's saying before he said it. So, you know, when you and I are speaking, we just give thoughts off the top of our head, more or less. There may be something beneath that in our head somewhere that it's coming from, but we answer immediately. And with him, you could get a few minutes to think, you know, as his, what he was going to say started to take shape, you could start thinking about it. So it was a totally, you know, much deeper, more like profound discussions because you actually contemplate things. So that's, you know, I got used to that, and it was, that was very different, very good. And, you know, at other times, if I could just sit there and also get into a very zen-like state, you know, you just got very relaxed with it. And so that was, you know, that was interesting. And, he, even though everything was so difficult for him, it was striking how he did not let anything go. I mean, we would argue over individual words and, you know, for me, the argument wasn't that hard to do because I'm speaking, but, you know, he would have to go through a lot of work to present his side. So, but he's never gave up. I mean, he was, you know, as he said, one of his best and worst qualities was stubbornness. So, you know, and I don't think he could have got through life if he wasn't stubborn. Look at all the barriers he had, physical barriers to existence, you know, and, And the other major quality was humor. He had an amazing sense of humor. He could still smile. He had a really big smile. He was very expressive with his face. So you could give yes or no questions. He had expressions he gave for yes or no. I mean, he had one of them. I quoted this in my book. I don't remember exactly what his assistant said, but, you know, it was something like that steely look of disdain or something. He really didn't like what you said. I mean, he could, it wasn't just yes or no. He could definitely give you a super yes and a super no. Right. Supernova, yeah. So,
You really knew when you'd said the wrong thing.
Exactly. Right, either sometimes because there was one face for what you said was stupid, which I don't know if he did that on purpose, but you could tell that he was thinking that. There's another face for what you said irritated him.
Something that's just struck me in what you said there, given, you know, how much, you know, so you said he was obviously a kind of stubborn, in a positive way, you know, he stuck to his guns. So he always put a lot of time and thought into what he said. Would you only talk about the work or what other things did you talk about?
Oh, no, we talked about everything, you know, from the Israel situation, American politics, British politics. You know, we did it. We went to movies together. You know, just talked about whatever. So it was like, you know, because we kind of became friends. Well, we definitely became friends at some, you know, and he would talk about anything, and he, you know, I sometimes you'd be sitting next to him and waiting for some profound or some very heated argument, and it would come out as a joke. He's waiting 5 minutes, you know, and it's like, oh, it's a joke.
Some punchline.
Yeah. And then you could play 20 questions. Oh, one thing that we have to get the knack of, you know, you could answer his questions or his comments before he finished them because he was writing them. And that was a good thing. And if you were right, it was a good thing because it saved him having to finish, you know, writing it out. On the other hand, if you were wrong, that you know, would be annoying to him. So you know, you see him typing and I go, oh, he's saying da da da. And if he's not saying that, you know, I remember, and you know, when I was first like trying that method, I would get it wrong 3 times in a row. He would like roll his eyes, like shut up for it. Occasionally, he would hit the wrong thing and a random sentence would come out. Or sometimes the computer would just generate put random things together. I think it was, I don't remember anymore, but I think it was maybe the, you know, the stuff he had deleted would be all there in some cache and it would just start reading that. But you'd be talking to him and it would, you know, you'd say, so are we going to the curry place for dinner tonight or you want to eat at your house? And he'd go, the answer would be, you know, the tree frog of the supernova exploded, Aristotle. It could be pretty hilarious sometimes. Yeah.
Do you have like what are some of your, and I'm, this is a really, you know, on the spot question, and I'm sure you'll go away and come up things, but what are some of your, you know, when you think about him, some of your favorite memories?
One was the night we finished Grand Design. We had been working on it for 4 years, and you know, he showed no sign of wanting to finish it through those 4 years, and we kept pushing the deadline. I mean, I think we originally were supposed to do it in a year and a half, and finally the publisher just told us, we're publishing it, you know, we're announcing it for next whatever, I don't remember when it came out, we're announcing, I think, for next September, so we expect to have, you know, it's like an ultimatum, really. But they didn't say it in a bad way. They just kind of very matter of fact, they said, you know, we put it on the schedule for next. So if it's not there by May 15th at 8 p.m. or something,
it's gone.
I don't know what they said, but something like that, you know. So we finished at 8 p.m. on May 5th, whenever they said exactly the minute. And I remember we had a little fight down to the minute about some little thing, and we managed to, you know, and he's, yeah, I don't know. And then when it's, you know, when it's all over, he says, I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, because I was thinking many times, we were never going to finish this book. This is just going to be my lifetime project. And of course, I was just doing stuff in between, but, you know, he had if I brought up, hey, you know, we got to finish this book sometime, shouldn't we be like pushing on, you know, not like massaging this chapter for, you know, and I'm a major rewriter. I rewrite 47 times, but, you know, he's even worse. Well, it's also because he, you know, he's so slow at it because of his, you know, illness. So, you know, his answer would always be, nope, doesn't matter when it's done, as long as it's good, you know? So then after that hour ticked by and we literally on that minute, which, you know, I'm sure we could have gotten an extra 10 minutes after 4 years, but on that minute we finished, you know, he kind of like steered the ship so that on that minute we would agree on the final point. And then he says to me, I said, wow, I can't believe we made it. He said, then he says, good thing we had the deadline or I would have never stopped. I'm thinking, why didn't you tell me this 2 years ago? I would have had them give us a deadline.
Was that because he just was enjoying it or because he just was a rewriter?
Well, I think he was enjoying it and he's a perfectionist, but I think both. Yeah. I was enjoying it too, but I was also going nuts because, you know, had to make a living and I had other stuff to do and, you know, going back and, you know, just kind of, you know, it just seemed like this would be a permanent position, you know, but at some point unpaid, I mean, you get in advance, but you know, eventually I guess they're going to ask for the money back if you don't ever turn in a book, you know, so, I mean, it's like, but, you know, when you're, you know, Steven, so they, you know, I mean, that was, we spent more than double what we were supposed to spend on it. And, hey, it all turned out good. But, yeah, it was, anyway, so that was one. Another good story was we went, one of his carers asked me if I wanted to go punting down the cam, which I guess I don't have to tell you what that means. But here in the States, I always have to explain, take most of the stories explaining what that means. So I asked Stephen if he wanted to come, thinking it was a long shot because, you know, well, for obvious reasons. So, and he said, sure. So the next day we did that. And, you know, that involved parking the wheelchair up at the top of this long, I don't want to call it a staircase, a long trail of wooden, stone steps, right?
Gosh, yeah.
And it's not wheelchair accessible. So we had to park it up at the top, carry him down all these steps to the, where the boats launch. And I started out carrying him because I could carry him myself, you know, he weighed like 95 pounds or something. And so, but then they didn't like the way, you know, it's hard. I mean, I would carry him sometimes in his office, like to the couch or something, but to carry him down all that is a bit of a, you know, exercise. And you know, you have to have his head right. You guys can't have his head flopping around. So mm-hmm. his carer said, no, put him down. We're going to do it. You don't know what you're doing. so they had these two kids, you know, so he's like 95 pounds. They're each like 95 pounds. Here I am like 185 pounds and I'm, you know, fairly muscular. At least I work out, lift weights and stuff. And,
yeah.
And they give me their purses to hold, one of which was pink. So I have these two little women carrying this guy down the Sphinx, followed by a guy holding a pink purse. You know? and we get down to the thing, and how that works. The guy, I forgot who was doing it. I don't think they supplied the purse. I think one of the group was doing the pole, whatever
the punting,
you call it.
Yeah.
That's called the punting. And, you know, you could, like, I said, oh, you try. I stood up there. And, oh, my God, I'm going to fall off. And they said, yeah, and the boats can tip over, too. And it's a flat boat. And he, you know, if it tipped over, I kept thinking, my God, if we tip this over, he's dead. I mean, there's nothing you can do. I mean, like, even if it's a normal person, it's hard to save a person who can't totally limp. How are you going to do that? So he's fine. He has his head on one of their laps. And they're turning, you know, he can't, when his eyes go to the right, they turn his head to follow his eyes, you know, his eyes go to the left, they turn his head. And I don't know, there were strawberries and champagne. It was a very nice time. But I mean, I'm thinking that, of course, you know, he wanted to go up into space and he went on the Vomit Comet and he was very intrepid. So it was very interesting because to me, that was a very vulnerable situation. You could have dropped him. He could have fallen off the boat or the boat tipped over or I don't know.
This is one of the things that is quite interesting. With all the, you know, he had his science, and that was he's had his science, a bit of a simple way to put it. But, you know, he had his work, which is kind of quite clear. What do you think it was about, and maybe, you know, what is it for you that makes you want to write about science and share it with people?
Well, when I was writing about physics, it's because I just thought it was so beautiful and fascinating, interesting, that everybody would love it if they just could understand what we're talking about. And so I just felt like the drive to tell people about this beautiful stuff. And, you know, so they, you know, yeah. And I wanted them on some more intellectual level, I wanted them to understand what is science about? How do we know these things? Not only what do we know, but how do we know what's our, you know, why do we think we believe this? You know, why is it good to follow these things? And why should you believe it today? Of course, in our American, you know, ridiculous, you know, culture here right now, you know, you're defending science. You're going, no, you can't just say, oh, it's no, there's no global warming or, you know, to understand what, you know, or the anti-evolution people who, you know, send up these people with ridiculous arguments that, you know, and people buy it. You need to understand what is the, you know, what is the difference between pseudoscience and science? So that's just another, you know, like something that I think Stephen and I both felt strongly about that we wanted people to, you know, to know the difference between pseudoscience and science so they don't get misled and so people don't make the wrong decisions. And I think Stephen felt the same way. He felt that people would find science beautiful, and it was beautiful and deep and important to the human experience. But there weren't a lot of people making it accessible. And especially when he started, I mean, he was he's not just a pioneer in black holes. He was a pioneer in explaining science to the public. Because in the 1980s, when he wrote that book, there were very few popular science books. So people writing broadly about science is really, really the key. And that's what Stephen did. I mean, he wrote about his own work, or his own field, I should say. See, it's like he wrote about his own field, not about his own work. So that's the difference. So a lot of people will write about their own little corner of what they did and try to make it sound earth-shattering. But Stephen wrote about the whole field, right? So like a brief history of time. It wasn't a brief history of my work. It included his work, but it was about it was some beautiful big topic, that was all those tangents. So that's probably not really relevant. But I'm just saying there are many.
That's about 50% of what we're talking about. How his book, his passion for sharing what he loved.
Well, he was one of the people. Him and Steven Weinberg and Carl Sagan. You know, they were the ones in back then who were the pioneers who started this huge, deluge of popular science books that we have today. And they all came from those guys, doing it back then. And it showed, that people saw, and Feynman eventually, a little bit later, I think, but not that long later with his anecdote books. So they all showed people, showed the publishers, I guess, and the other potential authors that people would be interested in this stuff. I don't think they had high hopes for it. I know I heard stories about A Brief History of Time that they didn't have, huge hopes for it. I mean, they didn't think it was they didn't totally dismiss it, because I think he got a decent advance for it, but they didn't have huge hopes for it either. They just thought, this is something to try and it'll be interesting, but they didn't expect it to be nearly what it turned out to be. Oh, who could expect that? But, So I think that he helped really to pave the way, for what we have today.
And just to touch on something you said earlier that you've reminded me of. So someone else we talked to said the part of the strength of that book was its clarity. It was just so clear.
A Brief History of Time?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, it's a slight...
Well, Stephen did not feel that way. Let me just say that.
Really?
Really, yeah. In fact, that's why we wrote A Briefer History of Time.
Right.
He said that, and it's, the beginning of A Brief History of Time was pretty clear, and it got hard to understand after that, which is why Stephen kind of himself said, that it's like the, I think he said, I forgot how he put it, but book that sold the most and was read the least. The average person found it tough going about after, I forgot, the first 100 pages or so, it started to get hard for people.
Yeah, and I'm one of those people.
That's specifically why he asked me to write A Briefer History with him. So that's kind of funny. And that's why it's called A Briefer. It's not really briefer. We had debated calling it A Clearer History of Time. So it's about the same length, but it's... We worked on making it, more understandable. And then that experience was such a good experience. Then I proposed to him that we write the second book, The Grand Design, because that book was based on his ideas that he had, his new ideas. In the time, I think we started writing around 2006. It was work he had done just over the last 5 or 6 years. And his work was developing as we were writing the book, which made it hard too. Cause at one point we had written, like a whole passage of 5 or 6 pages. And then I'm going to see him and we're supposed to be moving on. And he wants to make these changes. And I say to him, but Stephen, we went over this last time. This is how it works. Da, da, da. He says I've discovered it doesn't work that way.
Oh gosh. I suppose that's a nice problem to have. At least you've got it right.
No, it wasn't a nice problem to have. No. A nice would have been, we finished that, let's move on.
And was that what was driving him, really? When he's taking this time, I like the idea of him as someone, and like you said yourself, as a person who rewrites and rewrites and rewrites, you know. I think sometimes there's an image of a writer that just, they sit down at the keyboard and just, you know, it comes out first time.
I think my friend Michael Shermer called that the Amadeus myth for Mozart, you know, because they say that about Mozart too. And when you look, and I did some research on Mozart, actually for Elastic. And the truth is he wrote and rewrote and rewrote constantly. And he constantly looking for places, the pianos to play this stuff on. I forget all the details, but he had to find another. For a while, he didn't have a piano. He couldn't write. He had to go find, you know, borrow some. I mean, he was, you know, I forgot the story about how the myth happened, and it's not really relevant for this, I guess. But I do remember now. With some later writer made it up, and
right.
It somehow got into the, you know, but they've done great detailed studies of his letters, and you know, they found no, it wasn't like that. And you know, I'm not saying that there is nobody in existence who's like that, but that's image people have, just like the stupid movies, like this movie about Stephen, which I was invited to the premiere in Hollywood, and you know, even though the movie was, like as Stephen said, broadly accurate, I think was his comment.
Yeah.
You know, and people thought that was a you know, that he was endorsing the movie, which I guess he was, but I also know Stephen, and I know when he says broadly accurate, he also means not necessarily accurate in the details. You know, that was a good, I was a perfect Stephenism, you know.
That was Leonard Mlodinow on working with Professor Stephen Hawking. If you want to hear more, just look for the episode Remembering Stephen Hawking from March 2018 and let us know what you think with a rating or a review. Otherwise, there are plenty more science and tech stories to be found in the latest issue of BBC Science Focus magazine, where we look at the bacteria that can eat plastic, chew through carbon, and create food from thin air. Visit sciencefocus.com/subscribe for the latest subscription offers.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.